Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
But right now, we're in depth on where Clinton would spend, cut, and invest.
I believe every American willing to work hard should be able to find a job that provides dignity, pride, and decent pay that can support a family. So starting on day one, we will work with both parties to pass the biggest investment in new, good-paying jobs since World War II.
There's a lot of daylight between the economic proposals of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. We talked about Trump's last week, although the specifics were difficult to discern. You can find that discussion on my podcast. Today, we're taking a closer look at what Hillary Clinton wants to do on jobs and tax rates and deductions and more. And since I asked you about kitchen table economics last week during the Trump show, I'm going to ask to hear from business owners today. Is there a bottom line priority as a small business owner that you want to hear the candidates address? How does the near term future look for your business? So if you run a small business, you own a small business, I'd really like to hear about the priorities that are interesting and necessary for you, that you want to hear the candidates talking about when it comes to being a small business owner. And then talk to me this morning about how the near-term future looks for your own business. What are you most worried about? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter. You can talk to me about it there. It's at Carrie NPR. Elise Gould is with us. She's senior economist for the Economic Policy Institute, and she joins us today from in Minneapolis. Hi, Elise. Welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Jim Tankersley is with us. He's economic policy correspondent for The Washington Post and with us from D.C. And Jim, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much.
So, Elise, I wanted to play something that Doug Holtz-Aiken talked to us about last week when it comes to Donald Trump's economic plan. He said that he considers the lowering of the corporate business tax to be the most urgent economic item to address for the next president. And I want, at least, you to hear his thinking. Here it is.
One way they can avoid paying the high statutory rate is to take their earnings and never bring them back to the U.S.,
yeah.
Park them offshore. And as a result, they don't get plowed back into our economy. And that's, you know, just very perverse incentives if you want to have people hired in the U.S. and factories expanded in the U.S.
So would you say that that is one of the most urgent economic issues that the next president has to address?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't say that is. We have heard candidate Trump talk about tax reform. There's no evidence that his plans, you know, across the board reductions, in fact, reductions in the number of brackets, ending estate taxes, there's really no evidence that that's going to boost the economy and lead to faster growth.
Jim, what would you say about that?
I mean, I think that other economists would disagree with Elise. That there are certainly, particularly Doug and other conservative economists would say that a cut in the corporate rate, which Donald Trump is proposing a huge cut in the corporate rate down to 15%, is the sort of thing that would unleash more investment in the United States. There are studies that question that. There are studies that suggest that cutting corporate tax rates is a good way to raise middle class income. So I feel like on the Trump side, you know, he is making a decision based on fairly standard conservative economic thinking to cut corporate taxes and estate taxes as a big part of his plans. Secretary Clinton is not making that decision. She's talking about very different priorities in terms of supercharging the economy.
What's interesting, I think, about this, Jim, is President Obama has also talked about the need to lower the corporate tax rate. Secretary Clinton seems to be concerned about that $300 billion hole that lowering the tax rate might blow in the budget. Why isn't she as interested in this as plenty of Democrats are, too?
Well, for one, this is the thing that a lot of Democrats talk about, a lot of Republicans talk about, but we haven't seen any real action on in a long time. And if you look at her proposals, she is trying to put forth, I think, a lot of things that she thinks can get passed. Now, this may sound crazy because corporate tax reform is one of the very, as you just mentioned, large issues of bipartisan consensus in Washington. But it's also a big lobbying fight back and forth between different types of companies, different types of businesses, different different people who want different things from the reform. There's a reason why I've been in Washington 9 years, and every year I've been here, corporate tax reform has been 2 years away. that reason is that it's a really hard thing to do, and so she is focusing on different things. I mean, the last reason is that I think that if you think about the sell to your typical voter in a swing state, promising them that I'm going to cut the tax rates on big corporations does not seem as enticing as promising a lot of other things that are much more directed at their own lives personally.
Elise, we also talked about tax inversions last week because we were talking about these corporate tax rates. They were a hot item this time last year. Are a lot of companies still looking at this, and do you think this is an issue that the next president really has to do something about?
Yeah, I think when we think about Secretary Clinton's priorities, it has not been about reforming the tax code. She does have some plans to close loopholes, but I don't see this as being one of the priorities that she has as compared to infrastructure spending, as compared to really giving workers opportunities to share in the growing economy. I think tax policy is a third, fourth, fifth down on the list of her priorities.
Yeah, I guess I'm asking you, though, whether you think this tax inversion issue is as urgent for companies as it was this time last year. We did several shows, you know, because of what happened with Medtronic and some of the other companies, and whether this is something that is enough companies are looking at that the next president's going to have to deal with.
Right. I can't say that I'm an expert in that area, so I should perhaps not comment on
it. Okay. So let's talk about personal income taxes then, Elise, with you. Trump's talking about shrinking 7 brackets to 3. Do you have an idea of the income scales that those 3 brackets would encompass, and specifically what Hillary Clinton is doing with the brackets that we have?
Right. So as you've mentioned, there's some ambiguity as to exactly how he's going to plan those 3 brackets. He has talked about getting rid of the 0% bracket. He's talked about putting that, you know, back in. It's not particularly clear. I think he's argued that if you simplify it and go from 7 brackets to 3, it's going to make it easier. But I don't really see that as simplification. I think what Secretary Clinton is focusing on is closing some tax loopholes and actually making it more simple.
Mm-hmm.
So I see them as having a very different focus.
Does her plan look to you, Elise, like it truly does? I mean, as Jim said, he's been here for a long time and everything is always 2 years away. So is simplifying the tax code. Everybody talks about it. Nobody does it. I mean,
yes.
Do you see her plan as actually being a simplification of what we have?
No, I mean, I don't really see, I agree with you, and I agree with both of you, in fact. I think that simplifying the tax code is perhaps farther into the future than as a priority. I don't see it being a priority in the first 100 days as the kind of plan that is being put out.
Okay. Jim, do you understand, first on the Trump, because we really had a difficult time trying to figure out where these income spectrums fit into going from 7 to 3 brackets. Maybe you have some insight on that, do you?
My insight for you is that those details are not released and you may
okay.
not see them. I mean, no, seriously, the campaign has not released those details. It is possible they will release those details before the election. Without those details, now it also is possible that they are just going to let us infer that it's the same breakdowns as the House Republican tax plan. In his speech, he mentioned that sort of these brackets are in line with the House Republicans. So if that's the case, then we do have some things we can go off of, but it's hard to know, and it's you know, there's a case that several of Donald Trump's advisors make that policy ambiguity is okay because you just want to give people broad strokes of where you're going. If you give them too many details, they'll just pick on them. That is not Secretary Clinton's approach, by the way. She has released a lot of details, though not all the details that you might like to see from her, but a lot of them. So on his plan, I think it's very fair to say, for most people, he's at the bottom of the spectrum. He is promising an expansion of the 0 bracket, which is that the people who don't pay any taxes. In the past, he has called for doubling the standard deduction of what people can take for their taxes. That would result in fewer people actually paying federal income taxes. Everything else is tough to tell, except for that it's very clear that the people who make the very most money in the economy, the top income earners, would see a tax cut because the top marginal rate would fall from almost 40% now to 33% under his plan.
Let me come back to Clinton, to you, Jim, in just a second. But Elise, I want to ask you about that widening the zero bracket. Is that a good thing for low-income Americans? I mean, does he have something here that you could even get behind?
Right. I mean, it's an interesting question in terms of balancing out broad tax cuts for the top, you know, pretty generous tax cuts for the very top, including, you know, eliminating the estate tax, which is really about the top of the top of the top. And then thinking about expanding the 0% bracket, I think that it's interesting that comes in hand with other policies that rely on taxable income to even bite at all. So like his plan for excluding child care expenses from taxation, that if you extend that bracket, if you lower taxes, you're going to actually see even less of a benefit of that kind of a policy for low and moderate income Americans. So that could be, you know, that's, you know, think about if you're trying to do everything with the tax code, you could be entering some problems there as well.
Jim, back to you on the Clinton details on income taxes. Is Hillary Clinton doing anything with the brackets that we currently have? And as far as simplification goes, what Elise and I were talking about, where it's hard to see how simplification actually happens in the near future.
Yeah, several of Secretary Clinton's plans would make the tax code perhaps even more complicated. For example, she's going to start treating capital gains taxes differently depending on how she's going to change the treatment of them for people who don't hold them for a certain amount of time, the assets. So that's more complicated. She is making changes in that she's going to tax people at the top more. She's putting on what she calls like a multimillionaire surcharge, which is for taxpayers, 4% surcharge for taxpayers making more than $5 million per year. She's going to put in what President Obama has long called the Buffett rule, which is essentially a way of trying to force high-income people to pay a certain percentage of their income in taxes, no matter what sort of tax avoidance strategies they might use. And then she's got other loophole things on the corporate rate, which she wants to close. So in general, you know, she wants to make basically very rich people pay more money, and she's going to employ some complicated things to do that because you sort of have to.
So the simplification of the tax code is probably not going to happen under her.
Well, I wouldn't rule that out, by the way. I mean, certainly if she came in, and even though she's not campaigning on it, if she came in and she has a narrow majority, say, in the Senate or a divided Senate and a Republican House, it won't be one of her first priorities, but it might be something if Paul Ryan decides that it's in his caucus's interest to work with her to pass a priority of the business community, then they might be able to find some common ground around something similar to what President Obama has proposed, for example, on corporate taxes. But so I wouldn't rule it out that something she would do. I just don't see any indication she would make it a priority. And certainly the things she's telling us she would make a priority economically are very different from that.
You mentioned the estate tax a few minutes ago. Donald Trump wants to, if I remember this right, wants to do away with the estate tax. I don't understand all the focus on the estate tax. It is only applicable to people with estates, at this point, I think over 11 million. Is that right, Jim?
It's a very, very small slice of estates that are affected.
So why do we spend so much time hearing
really well
about it?
It polls. People don't like the idea of what the Republicans call a quote death tax. Even people and it has long been sold as something that affects family farmers, very sympathetic. Although there is no evidence that reporters have been able to find of a single family farm having been sold in America to pay off the estate tax. But it is a thing that people worry about, and a thing that people think is unfair. And so it polls well. It is not, though, the sort of thing that you're going to win an election on. But it is the sort of thing that if you're a Republican, many of your big donors are going to care a lot about. And so, you know, both sides do this. There are certain policies that get written because your donors really want them. But in this particular case, this is one that appeals more to the Republican donor base than Secretary Clinton.
Yeah, Lisa, I get that, where Jim is saying, you know, you're speaking to a certain amount of your donor base when you talk about the estate tax. I think average Americans think this is something that's going to affect them. It's not.
That's correct. The 11 million is right. So for married couples, that's, you're talking about estates greater than 11 million. For singles, it's, you know, 5.5 million. That's a lot of money. That affects a very small share of the population, but it does raise a significant amount of revenue. You know, it's non-trivial there. So when people are talking about that politically, it's completely a political point, and it's not, you know, that's something that Trump has in his policy to grow the economy. That is not something that's going to grow the economy.
And you should just explain your thinking on that. Why?
Well, there's no reason to think that that money that is getting taxed is going to be spent to grow jobs, to increase the size of the pie, to really be passed on to workers in any real way. So there's no reason why that is actually a job grower for this country.
Yeah, we're going to talk with our guest this morning, Elise Gould. She's a senior economist for the Economic Policy Institute, and Jim Tankersley, he's the economic policy correspondent for The Washington Post, invited them in today to break down some of the details of Hillary Clinton's economic plan. You can hear our conversation about Donald Trump's economic plan last Thursday. Catch it on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller right there. And we're building on some of the ideas, or mixing in, I guess, some of the ideas that we talked about on Thursday today to compare them with what Hillary Clinton has talked about. I also want to hear from you this morning about from business owners, because we talked about some of those kitchen table economics last Thursday. So if you're a small business owner, is there a bottom line priority that you want to hear the candidates address? Frankly, I haven't heard a lot from the candidates about small businesses, something I'll ask our guests about, but also you. How does the near-term future look for your business? I mean, what is the thing that you are most concerned about as a small business owner, and some of the other economic issues that you're hearing about this morning, just as an average American taxpayer? What comes to mind? What are you worried about? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at CarrieNPR. George in Richfield says he's a small business owner. He and his wife operate the Richfield Bus Company. Both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party have not been good for our business. Jim, does enough attention get paid to what's happening with small business owners in the country economically?
I mean, economically, there's a lot of focus on small business politically. There's not been a lot of policy focus, I wouldn't say, on small business, except for the problem is, of course, trying to discern how do you help small business in a way that is different compared to helping large business, and why would you want to necessarily? I mean, there's lots of reasons why. In particular, new businesses are a thing that a lot of economists believe that we should be spending a lot more effort trying to help. I would push back just a tiny bit, though, on the idea that politically you don't hear much about small business.
Okay.
I think you hear a lot about small business politically. You just don't hear a ton substantively.
Oh.
But I would add, I mean, Secretary Clinton, in some of the deeper wonkery that she's gone into in this campaign at times, has put forth a big plan about small business that is largely about access to capital and cutting some regulations and trying to do some tax changes for them that are different from large companies. I mean, there was a moment when it looked like she was going to try to position herself as a small business candidate. I think that she's gone in a little bit of a different focus direction economically, particularly as she tries to play herself off of Donald Trump. But, you know, Donald Trump, on the other hand, has proposed what would be an enormous tax cut for most small business owners, which reduces the tax on so-called pass-through income, people who are S-corps or LLCs, which is how most small businesses are organized. It just so happens that that also would benefit other companies that benefit from that structure, including the Trump Corporation. So the whole Trump organization is basically built of essentially the same kind of structure that small businesses use. So that shows how difficult it is to tailor policy for small business. Here is a plan he has to cut the tax rates for some of those owners from 40% to 15. That would be a big thing for those owners. It would also be a big thing for Donald Trump and a lot of big folks like him. And so how do you say that that is an advantage to small business versus the big guy?
Got it. To the phones to Kim in Rochester. Kim, you're a small business owner. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what kind of a business do you own?
We're wealth planners. So we have about 20 financial planners across Minnesota and into Chicago. And so we're dealing with, you know, primarily middle America, a lot of retirees. And so my comment was about the two things, actually, the estate planning question.
Yeah.
And that's a really common thing to have sort of average Joe American come into our office and say, oh, I don't need to deal with that. There's no way I'm going to have that much money. And what people forget is that this happens at death. And so a lot of people have life insurance that has to be included in that number. And I think the biggest objection that I have to the whole idea of a death tax is that you've already paid taxes on this money. You pay capital gains taxes, you pay, you know, income taxes.
Mm-hmm.
All these taxes have already been collected. And so to just simply whack off a big chunk of it, and you know, the idea that, well, it's for $11 million or greater, it's still your money that you've presumably worked hard to earn for your family, and you've already paid your taxes on it. So I think that's the biggest objection, is to take such a big chunk just because someone died is, it's kind of unfair, in my opinion, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm glad for the call because, Elise, this is something that Donald Trump talks about when he says it's a double taxation. Is Kim right? You've already paid money on this. That's the inequity of it.
I think that the misconception is that it's going to hit people that it's really not going to hit. I mean, you're right. You're taxing wealth that may have already been taxed as forms of income in other ways. That is true, except for the fact that, you know, I just want to say, in addition, if she's talking about helping many middle-level Americans, many who have very little wealth, we have seen that wealth is incredibly small for the vast majority. Many people have zero wealth in this country in terms of what their assets are. Even their housing wealth, we've seen that decline dramatically. And so to think that $11 million is going to hit a lot of people is actually just wrong, and many people are not going to have to pay any of that.
Although, Jim, I think Kim probably does work with some farmer landowners whose land is worth a significant amount of money. I think you said that reporters have been trying to find farmers who have been affected by the estate tax and haven't been able to.
I mean, at this particular level, I know that, I mean, I'm not sure that anyone has done it this cycle yet, but I have several times read stories in the past and have even a couple times tried to call people and find answers to the question of, can you show me someone who had to sell their family farm, not someone who had to pay a tax, but had to sell their family farm in order to pay an estate tax? And there just are not. And that's because that's the thing that's held up as the example. I mean, I think the other point that advocates of taxing estates make is that wealth inequality is large in this country, and that inherited wealth, sometimes it's not that you worked for the money that you passed down to your heirs. Sometimes it's just money someone else passed down to you. Now, it's true that money was taxed at some point, but that the idea that an increasingly small amount of Americans control an increasingly large amount of the country's wealth, if you believe that's a problem that policy should at least in some way try to solve and to avoid such a high concentration of wealth in the hands of a few, then an estate tax is a fairly efficient way to reduce that effect.
You know,
if you don't think that's a problem, then obviously you don't favor estate taxes.
Kim's still on the line, Jim. Maybe she's a source of one of these families. Kim, have you had clients who had to sell land or sell the farm to pay their taxes?
More often what we have is our clients who recognize that they I have two comments on that, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I'll answer the question, then I have one more comment, one question for your guest. The first So the comment is this. More often than not, what we have are farm families who come in and recognize that they are going to have a significant problem upon them. And so, you know, putting into effect laws that you know, change the current landscape, all that we do is work around them. It just makes it harder for us to preserve the wealth of the people who have been working their whole lives to generate that wealth. And this is my comment. So it's a good segue that, you know, we hear all the time, especially right now during political season, how, well, they just inherited that money. It's not really that they worked for it. But, you know, I'll tell you this. I grew up in a trailer on food stamps, and I've built my business up to a point where it's quite successful, and I'm proud of that because I'm able to employ a lot of, you know, people, and we're a family, and I take care of them. The idea that I've spent, I have three children, and the idea that I've spent half my life away from them building this, and that if it weren't successful, I have no safety net for myself. As a business owner, you don't get unemployment. You don't, if the business fails, you fail. You're on the street. That's it. And so the idea that I've put so much into this, and that I could die, and 15 years from now, someone would just say to my child, well, you just inherited that. You just inherited it. They invested in it, too. They didn't have their mother around. So I think we need to take a step back and simply ask ourselves this question. If it's unfair for one person, why isn't it unfair for another person? Unfair practices just aren't fair, whether you're a billionaire or whether you're on the street. And we just need to treat everyone fairly and stop this conversation about, well, you just inherited that. It was just passed on to you. Yeah, through somebody's Latin equity who loved you. So it's not that these rich people at the top are horrible people. If you stop putting your hands in their pockets and taking it from them, they would gladly put more in where they feel it's important.
Okay, Kim, I'm really glad that you stayed on the line and you continued with some thoughts on this. I want to hear what Elise and Jim have to say, Elise, to the logic of her argument there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I hear the feeling of insecurity, the feeling of risk, and knowing that you have put so much time and energy and devotion into your business, into your family. I think that's really important. I think it's important that so many people have made those investments and have worked really hard. And I think that there is risk involved in becoming an entrepreneur. There's risk for many people in you know, the jobs that they take, and they might lose their job, they might lose their business. And I think that's one of the reasons why we need to have such a strong social safety net to make sure that if the business fails or if somebody loses their job, that we make sure that we have that safety net for them to make sure that Americans don't fall too far. And I think that that is the kind of plan that Secretary Clinton, we've been talking a lot about taxes, and there's a lot more to an economic growth plan than
yes,
taxes.
Understood. And we'll get to that. Jim, to Kim's argument that I think she's right that we tend to say it's inherited wealth. You didn't really have to sacrifice for that. I think she's giving us a different perspective on that.
I mean, I think that it's pretty well universally acknowledged among economists that we need more people like Kim in our country who take risks, who work hard, who build value for the economy. I mean, what she's doing is providing a service that provides value to her clients, and we need more of that. We need more entrepreneurs. You know, when we're fighting about an estate tax of with the thresholds we have now, for the most part, though, we're not fighting about people like Kim, and I think that the focus on the estate tax as a political issue obscures. I mean, it obscures fights or can overshadow fights about other things that relate to, for example, entrepreneurship and how to encourage more people, about economic insecurity, what she's talking about the fear of not being able to pass on to your children something of value. You know, we saw a lot of people lose that very asset that they had worked hard their whole lives to pass on to their children during the financial crisis with housing. So we are living in a time in our country, I think, when a lot of people are feeling this deep insecurity about being able to pass a better life or the fruits of their own hard work down to their children. That's a much bigger argument than just the estate tax. That's an argument about how the economy works, about how value is created and kept, and it's an argument about fundamentally how policy can help encourage the sort of things that build wealth, income, and assets for people across the country.
Conversation here, if you've just gotten in and are trying to get your bearings in what we're talking about this morning, we're taking apart Hillary Clinton's economic plan. We did this on Thursday with Donald Trump's. We've gotten locked a little bit here on the estate tax. As Elise points out, we haven't talked about job creation at all, which I want to do. We have an excerpt from Hillary Clinton's plan about how she's thinking about job creation. So Elise Gould, Jim Tankersley, continue with us. I hope if you own a small business, I see a number of you asking questions about this. Feel free to weigh in here about the priorities that you want to see the candidates for president pay attention to when as a small business owner, and some of the greatest challenges for you. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Talk to me about it. Ask your questions on Twitter. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. And we'll continue with the conversation here and your calls and your questions on the other side of news. Phil, what are you watching?
Hi, Carrie. The Republican Party is launching its first ever election campaign in Israel. It's trying to persuade the high concentration of Americans living there to vote for Donald Trump. Trump speaks in Ohio today and plans to tell voters that the U.S. should work with any country that wants to wipe out the Islamic State group, regardless of that country's ideology. Hillary Clinton campaigns in Pennsylvania, where she will be joined by Vice President Joe Biden today. Rivers in the Baton Rouge, Louisiana area are starting to fall, but the National Weather Service says they still remain above flood stage. There's a flood watch until mid-afternoon, and the Weather Service says it'll likely be extended. Over the weekend, more than 20,000 people were rescued from floods as rain-swollen rivers flooded their banks. In Mississippi, emergency management officials say more than 70 homes have been damaged by flooding. A fast-moving Northern California wildfire has destroyed more than 100 homes and forced thousands to flee, an area where drought conditions and high temperatures are making firefighting difficult. The California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection says the fire in Lower Lake, about 90 miles north of San Francisco, has scorched nearly 5 square miles. No injuries have been reported. The flames jumped a road yesterday and moved into an area still recovering from a wildfire a year ago. And firefighters in Portugal and Spain are battling scores of wildfires after a week of the worst fire destruction in years on the mountainous Iberian Peninsula. The blazes have killed at least 4 people in Portugal and 1 in Spain and forced hundreds to evacuate. Spanish police have made several arrests of suspected arsonists. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:38.
Discover what matters in election coverage. You'll get stump speeches and breaking news, but you'll also get stories you wouldn't expect.
A politically active Latina Republican says he's not only supporting Donald Trump, but raising money for him.
The states with the highest levels of inequality have been backing Hillary Clinton, not Sanders.
Many immigrants are trying to become citizens so they can vote against Trump.
Elect NPR News on air and online at nprnews.org.
If you heard my thread must read on Morning Edition this morning, you heard me talking about Jeffrey Toobin's new book about Patty Hearst. He's at the Fitzgerald Theater on September 28th. Yeah, we'll talk about how the 70s counterculture touched Minnesota and St. Paul. Sarah Jane Olson arrested here and released in 2009. And of course, we'll talk politics. Jeff Toobin at the Fitz with me on September 28th. Buy your tickets on the thread.
Science reporting on NPR News is supported by 3M, working to improve lives worldwide through volunteers and investments of more than $1.4 billion in cash and products supporting education, community, and the environment. 3mgives.com.
And according to an independent analysis by a former economic advisor to Senator John McCain, if you add up all of Trump's ideas, from cutting taxes for the wealthy and corporations, to starting a trade war with China, to deporting millions of hardworking immigrants, the result would be a loss of 3.4 million jobs. Now, by contrast, the same analysts found that with our plans, the economy would create more than 10 million new jobs.
That's Hillary Clinton explaining her economic plan and specifics on how she would create jobs in the American economy. Elise Gould with us this morning, senior economist for Economic Policy Institute, and Jim Tankersley, an economic policy correspondent for The Washington Post. Elise, you rightly pointed out that we hadn't talked about job creation. What's the key specific? I hear her talking about creating a lot of jobs and talking about investing in accessible college and retraining. What's the key element that you see gets her to 10 million new jobs?
Well, I think there's three components to it. The first is infrastructure spending. So that includes things like modernizing roads, increasing broadband access, investing in new technologies, cleaner energy. So that's one component. Another is investing in affordable, high-quality education from preschool through college. So there's been a lot of talk about making debt-free college available. There's also components on there that I think have been overlooked about really high-quality preschool and affordable child care. And then the third component is giving workers an opportunity to really share in a growing economy. So that means making it easier for workers to form unions, strengthening collective bargaining, giving workers that leverage to get higher wages, and having better standards. So making the minimum wage increases, reducing wage theft, strengthening overtime rules. I think those are the three basic components of her economic plan.
Jim, do you understand this infrastructure piece of that plan as a kind of stimulus package, or how do you understand the way that adds permanent high-paying jobs?
I mean, there's two ways. The first is exactly what you just said, although they're not calling it a stimulus. There's a lot of temporary job creation from just the act of building these things, from laying concrete and improving bridges and maybe even, as she's talked about, doing a lot of wiring of homes for broadband. But the other way that it does is that theoretically, and I mean in very practical purposes, not theoretically, better infrastructure should allow for better job creation. If everybody has broadband in their home, maybe we can have better home-based internet businesses, for example. If everybody has, you know, easier ways to ship products from one place to another because the roads are better, then theoretically that should allow for more job creation for businesses that do that. So improved infrastructure is in that sort of way a double whammy, and it's something that Donald Trump talks about too, that if you create jobs when you actually build the infrastructure, and if you do it well, then you create jobs just from having improved investments in the country.
To what you were saying about infrastructure, Jim, Jan in Chisholm says he's a small business owner. He owns a pastry business. Commodity prices and shipping prices are so high that it cuts into his income. The amount of money it takes to get products out to the customer keeps getting higher and higher. To the phones to Joel in Minneapolis. Hi, Joel. Your question for us, or comment.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question that has to do with like the perception versus reality when it comes to the ability for an individual in a small business to make an income. And then so what my example is, I have a good friend of mine who's worked very hard for about 20 years and made probably $50 million. But then at the same time, the person will say that they can't make any money because of regulations and taxes. And it seems like a disconnect there. And it seems like also the trade-off with high taxes could be better infrastructure, kind of like what your last point was,
yeah,
better infrastructure, more control over corruption and so on, so that people who run small businesses or work for a small business are able to create that wealth that is the goal and create jobs and such.
Yeah, Elise, would you speak to that, please?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think when you think about the trade-offs in different economic plans, if you cut taxes too much, you're not going to have that much money to spend on other things like infrastructure. So when you think about making it more possible for small businesses to grow, and the I think the email that you had read previously about, you know, the costs of shipping or getting their products out, think about the investments in roads or the investments in energy that may be more affordable, all those things can help as well.
And Jim, to Joel's question about somebody who's done very, I think he said he has a friend who's made a lot of money, but he constantly complains about the taxes he's paying. Is there objective economic evidence to say that the level of taxes that small business owners are paying is holding them back from creating more jobs?
Well, I mean, you know, there's always evidence that if you weren't paying anything in taxes, if theoretically we had a world where we didn't need to pay any taxes and everything was doing great, then infrastructure just magically appeared and social safety nets just magically existed, then yeah, small businesses would have more money to be able to invest into their businesses. It's also true that we see, in particular with large companies right now, still very high profit margins. And so what we're looking for in this economy is for more investment. I think everyone can see in the stats that we could use a lot more investment. We would like it. The question is how to unlock it. And I think this is just a fundamental argument we've been having in this country for decades now, where Republicans say we unlock more investment by cutting taxes, and where Democrats say, no, we do other things. We invest in infrastructure. We do other things to unleash opportunity. We certainly did not see, I think, in the last round of tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts of the early 2000s, they did not unleash the sort of growth that was promised and the sort of job creation that was promised. It was the worst, even before the recession, the worst decade for job creation since we started keeping detailed stats in America. But that's one data point, and there are lots of others, and I think this is a big long-running argument that we're having. What Secretary Clinton's plan in particular does, though, is I think kind of tries to go at different parts of the equation. As Elise has been saying, she's treating taxes as a secondary component to many other parts, whether it's work-family regulations, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's all these different things she thinks will get people working more, companies doing more business, and the economy moving faster.
You know, Jim, here's the thing that I wanted to ask you and Elise about. For a time after the recession, there was a lot of concern about all the capital, all the business capital that was sitting on the sidelines, that companies were saying, well, things are too uncertain, we don't want to invest. Is that still the case? And can a president really do anything to get companies to invest more?
I mean, economic uncertainty is a thing that we've been hearing about for a long time.
Right.
We've stopped hearing about it as much. There's all this, there's policy uncertainty. They don't know what tax rates are going to be. I mean, for the most part, that has ended. The indices of uncertainty, which are fairly still rough as economic indicators go, have shown that we have less uncertainty now than when we did, you know, a few years ago.
But is there a lot of capital on the sidelines, though, Jim?
But there's still a lot of capital on the sidelines. So that suggests that maybe uncertainty isn't the big thing holding people back. It may be that you don't like what policy is, but you're certain, at least right now, about what it's going to be. And then the question becomes, well, why wouldn't there be, if there really is a rate of return out there to chase, by investing more money, why isn't someone doing it? Is everyone scared for the same reason? That's a big question, and it leads into some interesting arguments in economics right now.
So, Elise,
I think that when we think about, you know, what's going on with capital, it's important to bring in what's happening with productivity growth. So productivity growth has not increased at the same rate it had a few years ago. We have seen somewhat of a slowdown. That's partially because of this capital that's being underinvested. And so what we're also seeing simultaneously is that wages have been stagnant. And so since wages have been stagnant, it's relatively cheap for companies to hire more workers as opposed to maybe investing more capital that's going to make their workers more productive. So it's a catch-22. And I think, you know, until we see workers' wages increasing, maybe then businesses will find it more profitable to make more capital investments and make the workers that they have more productive.
Elise, I want to make sure I understood what you just said. It is less expensive, it looks, right now for companies to bring on workers because they're not going to have to continue to increase their wages than it is to make equipment investments and those kinds of things, which would make their companies more productive, which would mean they wouldn't need as many workers.
Right. So there's sort of a catch there. They want to make those investments, and I think they should be making those investments right now.
Yeah.
They may feel like they don't have to. Maybe they feel like they can hire workers. Workers may be more expendable to them if they don't need them in the future, and then mm-hmm. they can and make those decisions because workers are relatively cheap.
Jim, what's your assessment of that?
My assessment of that is that I agree with Elise that we could be seeing higher productivity growth and that there is very potentially a relationship with what we're seeing with labor. I also would note that the productivity question is big and complicated and it's a debate for an entire other show. But I do think that we are in this time right now that is frustrating that people are trying to get at with policy, which is incomes have been largely stagnant, that productivity is low, growth has been low, and there's this, even though the economy has recovered from the recession, it has not been great, and it has certainly not been what I think most Americans wanted that recovery to look like, both in the overall economy and in their own lives. And when you're talking about all these sort of wonky topics of investment and productivity, what we're really talking about here is the economy kind of humming at the speed we all want it to be?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're hard-pressed to find anyone who says, yeah, it's really doing right now what we want it to do for workers, for companies, for small business owners, for anybody.
But then, of course, the next question is this the way it's going to be? Is it the so-called new normal?
No, I don't believe that.
Elise,
sorry,
no?
Jim. Yeah, no, I don't think.
Yeah,
it's
no,
normal.
I agree. Please,
I think,
go ahead.
Yeah, I think that we have continued to see the economic recovery move forward. We've seen strong payroll employment growth the last 2 months in a row, and I think if we continue to see that over the next year, if we see that kind of growth, 260, 270, 280 thousand jobs being created every month, then we will eventually see the unemployment rate come back down to the 4% range. We could see that. We could also see pulling in another million workers who have left the labor force.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we see all of those things, when we really, truly reach a full employment economy, then we will see the stronger wage growth. Then people will feel that economy more in their pocketbooks and more in how they can support their families and their living standards. I think we will see that. So I don't think it's a new normal. I think it's been slow. One of the reasons why the recovery has been slow, because of after 2009, after we had our one big stimulus package, we didn't really do anything else. Government employment is still lower today than it was before the recession began. So we've stopped making those investments. There's been a move towards austerity policy, and that has been a drag on economic growth. But if we continue adding payroll employment like we've seen the last couple of months, it will come back. The economy will return, and wages will rise.
Lisa says on Twitter, as a small business owner, cash flow and difficulty obtaining lines of credit loans. Jim, I thought you mentioned that in Hillary Clinton's plan. Deepen the wonkage, I think you said.
Yeah, no, she has talked about this. She has talked about this as an issue that she wants to approach for small businesses, that she wants to unlock access to capital for small businesses to help them to start and to grow. And this is, like I said, this has been a long-running problem in the economy that we are having fewer and fewer startups as a share of our businesses. And that means, you know, new businesses that start small and that hopefully grow. But this has been a particular problem in the Great Recession. It's been a really big problem in vast swaths of the country that are not the sort of major superstar metro areas. So I think, you know, in large parts, counties in Minnesota, there are very low rates or even negative rates of business formation in this recovery. And that is an issue that I think policymakers have to deal with. And so the secretary has some plans that she's offered up that are her attempt to deal with that.
Yeah, a lot of those counties, I'd say, are probably outside of our major population centers, right, in some of the rural counties.
Yeah, no, it's and across the country, it's rural counties in particular that are struggling with this, that have seen such a drop-off in business formation.
Yeah. Scott says, to that point, to the comments about internet business and more broadband, companies need to trust more employees to work from home, to the phones here to Mark in North Oaks. Hi, Mark. Thanks so much for waiting.
I'm a retired small business person, and every time I hear this S-Corp garbage, it annoys me. You make a decision as a small business person how best to reduce your taxes. If you pick an S-Corp over a C-Corp, it's because you think that's going to let you take the most money out quickly and control your taxes. And to reward someone for picking a tax avoidance strategy seems to me to be silly. We also have to remember the reason we initially had an estate tax and accepted one was because the country believed it was a meritocracy and that we should not permit the creation of a moneyed aristocracy. And we are very much with this concentration of wealth moving in that direction. And if you want to help small businesses when they're starting, you deal with the workers' compensation insurance companies who charge higher rates to small businesses than they do to large businesses. I mean, that's a real problem for a small business getting started because you cannot pay benefits, but you have to pay workers' comp.
Let me put what you've said, Mark, to Elise. Elise, what about that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that Secretary Clinton is trying in her proposals, she's trying to make some simplifications for taxes, specifically for small businesses. I don't know if she's mentioned anything about workers' comp. Jim, have you seen anything there?
I haven't, but there are 37 different agenda items on her issues thing, and I confess to only having read about 30 of them, so I may have missed it.
Oh, my gosh. Jim, how did you get on this show? No. You so clearly know so much more about this than the rest of us. I'm really glad you're here. Jim, I wanted to say this, because we mentioned the investment in higher education for Americans as being a job creation strategy. We're actually gonna do this as an individual show, but I was struck by something she said in the speech about, I think she said nearly half of the new jobs that will be created by the year 2020 will not require a college education. But I think she has talked in other places about the need for high skilled job creation, where it's vocational kind of high skilled vocational kind of training. What do you know about that?
Well, I mean, what we know is that there are a lot of, first off, that just having a high school diploma is not a great ticket to the middle class anymore in America, and it hasn't been for a long time. But what you do after that in terms of skills training does not necessarily have to mean a four-year college degree in order to give you very valuable skills in the current economy. And so I think that the balance that policymakers all are trying to come up with is, how do you help people in the most efficient way possible get those skills? If you don't need a four-year degree to get the kind of welding certificate that we need for particular skilled parts of the economy, we should be able to find ways to get you that training faster, cheaper, more tailored to the needs, not just of the workers, but also of the businesses that need particular skills around the country. And this is something you see a lot on local policy levels, where community colleges work with states, work with employers, trying to figure out, what skills they can best help people in their economy gain to help power the industries going in their particular communities.
Yeah, Elise, it caught my eye because there is so much focus on college education. To hear that, we really have to shift some of this thinking around as far as where we're going to make investments outside of college is a little surprising. Thus, our discussion that's coming up on this, and I'm interested in your view on that.
Yeah, I think it's really important when we think about the college debt and the issues of college. I think it comes back to that same question that your caller, Mark, was talking about, the meritocracy. We want to make sure that it isn't money that's keeping people, high-qualified, lower-income people, from being able to get access to college. So that's the important point there. It's not that we necessarily need more college graduates. We want to make sure that the opportunity, that economic mobility, is really there. But I think the one point that Secretary Clinton has made very strongly is that a four-year college degree shouldn't be required to get a good job. And
right.
So to make sure, as Jim was saying, make sure that we have access there and make sure that companies can be working with community colleges, that they're investing in training programs, apprenticeships, and working with unions as well to make sure that those are good jobs and making sure that the labor standards are there so that for those people, the vast majority of Americans who don't have a college degree can get access to good jobs.
Hey, I really appreciate all the insight and the numbers crunching from both of you. Elise, thank you very much. Good to have you.
Thanks for me.
And Jim, thank you. Good to have you here.
My pleasure.
Jim Tankersley with us from the Washington Post, and Elise Gould with us from the Economic Policy Institute.